email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, the investigative podcast, Where is George Gibney? Which was broadcast on BBC Sounds, has been listened to over 3.5 million times worldwide. It brilliantly and sensitively tells the story of paedophile George Gibney, mainly through the voices of the survivors of his abuse. One of those featured is Trish Carney. Trish was a champion swimmer as a teenager, winning medals on a national level. She has also written a book, Above Water, about the impact of Gibney had on her life. Trish is here in studio. How are you doing, Trish?
Hi, Ray.
And also in studio, we have Mark Horgan. And Mark is the co-creator, producer, reporter of the podcast. And Trish and Mark and others are coming together for a very special evening in the National Concert Hall on the 20th of April, all in aid of One in Four. So good afternoon to you, Mark.
Hi, Ray.
Thanks to you both for coming in.
Thank you.
We've loads to talk about and we've loads of time.
Okay.
So we can relax into it. Do you want to tell us about the night first, just to relax everybody
please,
in?
Please, we'll get the plug in nice and early. So it's the making of Where is George Gibney for One in Four. It's in the National Concert Hall, April 20th, as you said. We're looking to sell as many tickets as we possibly can because it's for an amazing cause. All proceeds will go to One in Four. And the one and only Trish Carney here beside me will be there, as will many other brilliant people who took part in the series, like Burr Carley and Johnny Watterson and Gary O'Toole. And us producers will give a kind of behind the scenes look at the making of the podcast, and there'll be some unseen footage, some previously unreleased recordings. And really, it's such an amazing cause, One in Four, and it's very close to both of our hearts, because during the making of the series, many of the survivors that I spoke to were at the same time receiving counselling from One in Four. So I saw firsthand the sort of work that they do and the really positive effect it has on people. And really the demand for their services is such that there's a long waiting list for their counselling sessions. So if people can get on and buy a ticket, their money will go directly to just shortening that waiting time, getting more counselling sessions for survivors.
A great cause.
It's a really good cause. And so it's nch.ie and secondcabins.com for tickets.
It's going to be a very emotional night, Trish.
Yes, I would think so. But I think, you know, while it is a very, very dark subject, it's, you know, it's all in the telling.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, when Mark and myself and Burr and that get together, you know, there's always been a lot of fun and laughter behind the scenes as well. Mm. And I think, like, the people that have heard the podcast, they're fascinated by it. But there's so much to that podcast that people don't know, you know, as in the makings of it.
Yes.
You know, there's no way that I opened my front door and said, "Hi, Mark, wait till I tell you my story." You know, and the same is true for every single person on that podcast. And as I said to Mark as well, that, you know, we talk about the podcast now as a finished entity. But that was Mark's vision and creation. All those episodes, who went into them, what way it was done. So we're talking about a finished product. Whereas when Mark approached us, it was something we didn't even know the name of it. And, you know, we didn't know what was ahead.
You'd be cautious about talking to people.
I'd be very cautious.
Yes, no,
yeah.
And rightly so, rightly
yeah.
so. And I suppose the caution will be about other people exploiting your story.
Yes, and the fact that I suppose for 25 years, other people did talk about my story, but I didn't.
Yes.
And not that I, you know, I suppose for quite a large number of years, it was a secret. And then it became less of a secret. But even when it was no secret at all, it still wasn't something that I was comfortable speaking about. Mm. Not with anyone, not even at home, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't always that it was a secret. So then for me to, you know, have this fella appear and saying, you know, "Oh yeah, I'd like to make a podcast about it." You know, honestly, I wasn't interested.
No.
So and I was quite...
How did you end up here then?
Yeah. Well, I suppose he can be quite charming, that fella. And, you know, we were just talking about it even just outside for a wee second there. Like, and he when he came the first time to Cork, he didn't pry at all. And so he got very little back, but there was a relationship set up there. And Mark was in no rush. And he made that very, very clear. And he went away and I kind of thought, yeah, maybe I will do this.
Mm.
And then he came back the next time and I had gone the other way and I felt, no, I didn't want to do it, but I felt now I'd nearly committed. And instead of Mark just, you know, running ahead and going, I'll get her now, while she said yes, he took another hour, I'd say, at home, sort of saying, well, what are you nervous about? And it went from there, you know. Yeah. And I think there's a very telling image that I sent him the last day on the phone about how hard he had to work, because I was getting nervous and I sent him a message on email and he said, do you want to have a quick chat? You know, you can buzz me. And I emailed back, sorry, no offence, but didn't keep your number.
Oh. Yeah. And it's the way this story is covered, because it has been covered before again and again. And many people over the years have doorstepped George Gibney. Before we go any further, can we assume that everybody knows the story of George Gibney? We'll just give this a brief.
I don't think so. I think also it was what became apparent was there was this whole generation of people, you know, obviously in Ireland, but outside of Ireland, nobody knew about George Gibney and nobody knew his story. But in Ireland, there was a whole generation who weren't aware of his story, and that actually doing it as a podcast series was a really good medium to try and approach this, you know, particular age group. But the story of George Gibney is that he was an Irish Olympic swimming coach. He was kind of a renowned coach in the 80s and 90s to a very high level. He was also was known outside of the sporting sphere. So he had made lots of appearances in RTE, like constant appearances in RTE. It's fascinating seeing all the archive from the 70s right through to the 90s. And so he was highly respected and he was highly charismatic coach, but also he was a child sex offender. And it only from an individual who took every opportunity to publicize himself and, you know, what he was doing and who was always on air. Then when the story in December of 1994 came out in the Sunday Tribune that he was a child sex offender, he never spoke again.
Never.
So, no, never.
So here's the thing, because people who haven't listened to the podcast, you talk to people like Trish and Bear and other people, but you also go to Florida where he lived then and may still live. And you were attempting to get an interview with him, knowing that he hadn't spoken in 25 years. And you were hoping to do something that other people had failed to do. And was that, because I would imagine your aims around this evolved. So what did you say? Was that the big quest to get him to talk? Was that initially? No.
No, it wasn't. What? No. Because it was really unrealistic. We didn't think that was going to happen. So, you know, rather than, as you say, doorstep George Gibney, which, you know, say when people have in their heads what those programs are like, that, you know, it's like Panorama where a reporter's going and shouting after somebody and, you know, there's no reply and stuff like that. Like, that's the opposite of what we wanted to do. So we wanted to go and we wanted to observe. And that's what we did, first of all. So myself and my co-producer, Kieran Cassidy, we wanted to find out the social circles that he was in. Is he still around children? Is he working with children? You know, how connected is he to, you know, the religious groups? We found out that he had been in the past. And is he currently working? And we wanted to understand how he's viewed in society where he lives, and also then, you know, obviously attempt to talk to him and approach him and get a right of reply. But to be honest, from the start, this was about telling the story of George Gibney to as wide an audience around the world as possible through the voices of the survivors and people that knew him. And it wasn't about George Gibney, you know, speaking on the podcast. If he had and we got to interview him, great. But it wasn't really the goal, right? Because it was so unrealistic.
Yes, yeah. So eventually when he gained your trust, Trish, you told your story.
Yeah.
And so people were hearing your voice for the first time.
Yeah.
And I know you were writing the book at the same time. But what was going through your head? What were you, not that we live our lives that what did you hope to achieve, but you must have sort of catapulted yourself forward and thought about when this goes out, what
yeah.
will happen?
Yeah. Do you know, it was, I don't know, did I really think it through?
Right.
It was more a reactive situation rather than anything else. Like, I was reacting to Mark saying he wanted to make this, and the main thing, the main propulsion then ended up for me was that, did I really want to not be part of something that was going to tell my story again? And so that was probably my biggest kind of reason for doing it, that you know, for what was it, nearly 30 years I had always read and about my own story. I even remember when my little ones were tiny and they were in the car and would be on Liveline. And do you know, I'd be turning it on and then I'd be turning quickly off again because I didn't like what they were saying. But I can even remember with my wee ones in the car, I would be thinking, oh my God, maybe they'll even absorb this. Maybe in their life they'll remember that that conversation and, you know, that it'll click with them. So I'd be turning it on and off. And I suppose with the podcast, I just didn't want not to be a part of it. Not, you know, you can't give out about something if you didn't have a voice on it. And but the one thing that I was very nervous of was how I would be portrayed on it, because I do feel like and I would say that to any survivor out there, that there is hope. There's always hope. You know, tomorrow can always be better than today if you get the right support at the right time and the right help. And I felt that for me personally, I didn't want a very sad ancient old Irish story, you know, a Camalia about how sad our lives were. Because if you look at me, if you ever came out and out on a night out with me,
I do live
no. a happy life. Yeah, yeah. So that would have been my main focus. And at one stage, I rather cruelly said to Mark, and I didn't mean it as it sounded, I said, look, Mark, you know, I've gone into this with my eyes open, and if I'm disappointed, I'm disappointed. And, you know, I didn't mean it that if Mark's creation is rubbish, I meant that if it doesn't portray me in the light that I want to be, that's his vision, not mine. And I did my best and he did his best.
And I suppose you knew as well that you were writing the book. And so you're completely in control of the book.
Yes, hugely.
And control is a theme, isn't it? Because George Gibney controlled you.
Hugely,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it is very, very difficult to have someone else express an opinion on a part of your own life and to suppose they know.
Yes.
And maybe they do, but maybe they don't.
And his control, and like you write about it in the book, and you write about the years afterwards, and you use the expression over and over again, I'm not going to let George Gibney win.
Yeah.
That was a thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose there's an element of taking your life back.
Yeah.
You know, because for an awful lot of people, abuse, you know, transforms them, it changes them. I remember many years ago hearing a man on the radio, and he said he used to look at a picture of himself as a small boy, and he used to say that boy was murdered.
Yeah.
And I, while I never felt that myself, I do understand that people do feel that. And I just felt going forward, for me personally, I wanted to, you know, to live and to you know, release myself from those shackles.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean by not him not winning. It's not necessarily a win or lose situation, but it's more that I didn't want him to take any more, not one more day.
Yeah. It's interesting you brought up that man and the photograph, because in the book you outline where you went to counselling and the poor woman was getting nothing from you.
Nothing.
Yeah. And then she said, as an exercise, which she may have read about in the textbook or may have worked for before, she said, bring in photographs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think that, you know, counselling is phenomenal. And that's why 1 in 4 is amazing. It didn't work for me because I was pregnant with my second child at the time. I think I was very closed. When I see how closed I am now, can only imagine how closed I was back then. And it just wasn't working. She tried everything. Yeah. She said, would you write it? Would you do this? Would you do that? So she said, bring in the photographs and we can talk about it. So I did. I brought in, you know, oh, I was thrilled. I could do my homework at last. And I brought in all my photos, laid them out on a big, big table. And she said, did I notice anything? And I was thinking, I couldn't figure it out. But in the end, anyway, long story short, she said she picked 2 pictures. And one, I was 13, and the other one, I was 19. And the 13-year-old one was an international I was on just the summer before I joined Trojan, which was
the
swimming club that gave me.
Yeah.
And the other one was taken in Blarney Castle, and was my very first photograph taken with who's now my husband, Eamon. And there wasn't one photograph between the two.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the back of my mind, I had made that decision never to even take those photos from Dublin. Because she asked had I even got them at home. I didn't even have them in my house in Cork.
But you have blanks, don't you? There are blanks.
There are blanks.
Yes.
Yes. But I presume those blanks aren't really blank, but I'm just making sure they stay blank.
Yes. To protect yourself.
I think they must be there. There are reasons. There are definite blanks. There's way less blanks than there used to be. But I don't go searching anymore.
No,
I don't need.
Why would you?
I don't feel I need to heal it much more than I have in that sense.
Yeah.
You know, I accept my scars. That's probably.
Can I ask the two of you about, because you know, when people come to the podcast and, you know, I've read Deep Deception and I've read your book and I hate this man, you know,
yeah.
you know, and I've, you know, I've no skin in the game at all. But like you obviously suffered at his hands and you have spoke to the people who suffered at his hands. And how do you feel about him now, George Gibney?
Well, it's funny because the project, you know, has brought so many positives into my life, which are, you know, relationships with really phenomenal people that I've met, you know, and we've been through a lot of ups and downs. And this night in the National Concert Hall feels like a lovely up. It's almost like an end of the whole project, you know. How I feel is still angry. I feel that it's still absurd that he hasn't been brought to justice. I feel very upset when I listen back to Trish and Burr's episode 2 last night before coming in here to you, and I find it really upsetting, and I still find it upsetting. I find it even more upsetting since I have grown to know Trish and Burr even more. So yeah, I don't know. It's the project itself, Ray, was kind of funny because it went on for so long and I didn't really know what I was getting myself in for at the start. And when Gary O'Toole has said, you know, when he met me first, he said I had no understanding of the kind of Pandora's box that was opening. And so it then became so pressurized when, you know, I realized that, you know, I was Trish and Burr were, and Chalky and all the rest were trusting me, and that I had a duty to tell the story in the correct way. And there was a chance that this might be any good. And so it was a difficult project for a long period of time and a stressful part of my life, you know. But then when I'm looking back at it, I feel so grateful to have had the opportunity to do this this project. And I feel like we've done something really worthwhile. And so, yeah, when it comes to the project, I feel really happy to have been part of it. But of course, with George Gibney, just, you know, still total anger and disgust.
And there must be disgust about our legal system as well. So just remind people. Gary O'Toole contacted you, Trish. Then you gave a statement to the guards, as did a number of other survivors. And then he was arrested and brought to court. Mm. And take it from there then.
So he was brought to court, but then he made a challenge to the High Court initially, which was rejected, which was basically saying he couldn't get a fair trial. Then he
because they were historical and he couldn't remember enough to mount a case.
Really,
in his defence.
Yes. And the legal system at that time in Ireland, it was basically the start of the historic child sexual abuse cases. It was almost at the very start of the, you know, the cases against
the Ryan report.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're in a situation in the country where it was, and this is what Gibney and his legal team argued, that it wasn't possible for him to get a fair trial on the basis of the amount of time that had passed between the alleged offences and the current court date, and also the fact that he wasn't able to, he had no documentation or any other elements to that effect that for him to get a fair trial. So, you know, the really interesting thing is that, so to cut a long story short, it went to the Supreme Court, who then sent it back to the High Court, and the High Court accepted what he said. Yeah. So he'd never faced trial. But subsequently, another Olympic coach, Derry O'Rourke, tried to use the same defence, and then that was rejected, and it's been rejected ever since. So there was this one little window in the Irish legal system that allowed George Gibney to escape.
Get off on a technicality.
And then leave Ireland and move to the US.
And what I always found very, very difficult about that was that, if you know, what actually happened was, as far as I figured out, is that there was another man in between all of this who used the same defence, because I'd say they were stocking up at that stage. And it was eventually deemed that the reason that there was such a time scale between the prosecution and was because of his own course of control of the victim, and that's what changed everything, that he actually caused the delay.
Yes.
And that's what I feel, that's
what
I
interpret. Write about that, because it makes complete sense that as a, you know, 13 to 19 year old, there's so much going on.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of shame and self-blame, And it takes a long time to come to terms with that.
Yeah, and it's just phenomenal, I think, from a legal point of view, is that, you know, they're almost admitting they got it wrong, but, you know, we're never going back there. Sorry, you know, your case, we probably made a wrong decision there. But, you know, and they've proved that by never allowing it again. But, you know, for us, that there's no window open. It's closed. Once it's closed, it's closed.
And is justice important to you?
No.
Why not, do you think?
No, because I suppose even at the time, I never thought George Gibney would ever be brought to justice. I just couldn't see it ever happening. It was just a self-preservation thing, but he was always well able. And there was, you know, I always felt that he was always one step ahead. And look, if, for whatever reason, I was proved right.
Yeah.
I just think for me, that, you know, justice for people, when they say that word, they mean jail. You know,
yeah.
I have my freedom. I came to Dublin today never wondering if that fellow with the goatee across the road is Gibney.
Right, yeah.
It's not him. He's miles away.
Yeah.
I have freedom. Whereas, you know, Gibney was jailed, for other people, that is their freedom. But for me, I have my freedom, and that's my justice. But having said that, now that is because I'm many years down the road. At the time, it ate me, because it equated for me, Gibney getting off equated to, you're not believed.
Mm.
We don't believe your story. That isn't after happening now, you know. And this podcast was probably a hugely significant byproduct, in the most positive way, that when Burr and I in particular, because it's Burr I talk to, but everyone else that was involved in it, to know all of those people, you know, Lorraine, the Susan, their families, all of them were vindicated. All these people all over are going, yeah, Gibney, he's definitely, you know, did this. We all know it. That's very freeing. So that's the justice that, you know, I got instead of jail.
And during the abuse, those years, you didn't tell anybody. It was a secret.
Not so.
Now, some people did try to tell people that this was going on.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I suppose I didn't understand it, to be honest. I don't know. I don't know. Sometimes I look back and I think, what was I thinking? But I suppose, you know, and I was saying to Niamh, your producer yesterday, I was saying that it was just very interesting when Burr, in her part of the podcast, said, like, we weren't in dungeons being fed through a window.
No.
Like, we were with our families, and I was very happy with my family, and I did learn to parcel it off. But like, the level of parceling, I mean,
yes.
I don't know, was pretty phenomenal.
You say in your book there, in my twisted thinking, Gibney was a married man with children, a pillar of society, a respected coach, and I was a bad person.
Mm.
Despite knowing and understanding now why I didn't speak out, it is still difficult to quell the inner voice that says, I could have stopped it. I should have stopped it. Yet even as I condemn myself, I remember my shame, guilt and unquestioning obedience to Gibney. What many fail to understand is that breaking the silence of abuse takes more than courage. It takes time, healing and the understanding that I was a child and he an adult. This is why sexual abuse is so often prosecuted as an historical crime. That sort of says it all there.
It does. The end.
Thanks very much, commercial break. Well, actually, we will take a commercial break. We're talking to Trish Carney and Mark Horgan about Where is George Gibney and the night they're having in the National Concert Hall in a couple of weeks' time, and we will take that commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Where is George Gibney? There is a night in aid of 1 in 4 in the National Concert Hall on the 20th of April, which is this night, 2 weeks.
2 weeks,
Mark,
yeah.
Yeah, and we're talking to Mark Horgan, one of the producers on the podcast, and Trish Carney, who was one of the contributors. And Trish, this is a voice from your past. So honoured to have known Trish. We were young nurses in St Vincent's Hospital in the 80s. And I know that we were no support for Trish because we didn't know about anything. She was a fabulous young nurse. And now when I think of what Trish was going through, she's an extraordinary human being. I'm privileged to have known her. And that's Sandra Corcoran. She says she'll definitely support the fundraiser.
Yeah.
Nobody knew what we were going through.
No.
At that stage, and you say, I heard you say somewhere that he was unhinged at that stage. You were in first or second year nursing in Vincent's.
Yeah, I think because the abuse, obviously had lessened, which I now realise he'd moved on to a lot more younger girls. But he had some sort of a fixation. You know, I don't think he had the same level of madness of trying to control. Maybe he thought I was a loose cannon, mm-hmm. you know, but he was, you know, he used to come to the hospital. He used to be on the ward. He'd be waiting by my car. He'd follow me even after I met Eamon. You know, he didn't know where Eamon came from because Eamon was from outside of Dublin. But he obviously knew of his existence. Mm. And I can remember going bowling one night and we got on our bowling shoes. And next minute I saw him out of the corner of my eye and I just said to Eamon, I actually don't feel like bowling anymore. And we left. And I'd say Eamon thought, what is wrong with her? But I couldn't tell him that that fellow over there is following us. You know, I just it was a very, very difficult time. But actually, it never even dawned on me until Gary's letter that I wasn't the only one. Mm. It never dawned on me. And subsequently, I know quite a few of my own generation that I would have known extremely well were going through it at the exact same time. And I've still to this day have found that very, very, very difficult. Both to realise that I never told anyone and therefore might have stopped it for someone else. But also just to know that, you know, my goodness, it wasn't only me. Everyone, loads of people were going through this hell.
And what about people like Eamon and your family when they found out what you were going through? What was their reaction?
It was very difficult. Very, very difficult. My mum took it very, very hard. And Eamon, do you know, Eamon's very relaxed in life and is very, you know, take it as it comes. So I think one of the reasons that I have healed so well is that Eamon never set out to make me better. You know, he just let me be.
Because usually us men want to fix it, don't we? That's our.
So he was always, you know, he didn't try to fix me. And that in itself was what I needed personally. Everybody is different, you know. So obviously from that point of view, we were the right fit. I do remember when the podcast came out because, you know, like even though it was all going to go to the court and everything, it would have been a revelation to Eamon in the court because I still hadn't talked to him about it. I just, no, and didn't want to. And he was incredibly uncurious because I could never have done that. But I remember when the podcast came out and Mark gave me a preview of my speaking. And that was the first time I saw Eamon's reaction. And he came in and he was like, he's not overly emotional. But I could see that, you know, it had hurt him. And he just said, I don't know. And I said, like, what? What do you mean you don't know? And he said that, first of all, he said, I don't want you to write your book. Because, not that, of course, he didn't want me to write it because I was there. Oh, sorry, a bit late for that. But what he meant was, he didn't really process how difficult it would be and how hurt he would be for me. But also he said, and I thought it was a very good way of putting it, he said, I always knew something happened, but I never knew what something was.
Right.
And so it was probably a lot very quickly.
Yes.
But he accepted. My poor mum, it was very, very different for her and for my family because I remember one of my brothers saying he had to rewrite his past because it wasn't the past.
Ben.
Yes,
yeah.
It wasn't what he thought. And then also Michael, who would have, you know, we were literally reared as two separate.
You were the two youngest in the family.
Yeah, the Waynes. And I'd say it was very, very hurtful for him that, you know, number one, why would I not tell him? If I told nobody else. And, you know, so he had to come to terms with that. And as I say, mum hadn't got my dad. You know, my father had passed away at that stage and she was alone. And I think her greatest fear was that I wouldn't make it. That my marriage, who she knew how much Eamon meant to me, this was very early days in our marriage. We had one small little one at the time. And I think mum had a huge amount of fears, as well as not even knowing what I was talking about. Yeah. She couldn't get her head around
it. Could she not?
No, she found that very difficult. And of course, we were never going to talk about it anyway, myself. Like, how was I going to talk to her? I don't even talk to Eamon. So it wasn't fair but of course I blamed her for not immediately embracing me and saying how terribly sad this was.
Doesn't that say an awful lot about Irish society back then? No wonder people were, you know, not permitted, but they could get away with these things because it wasn't talked about.
Yes.
But I also think that a major change that we could see when the podcast came out is what I was, you know, what became really clear when we were researching this was when the story came out in the Tribune in 1994, there was a really different reaction from the public. Like, there was obviously some support, but...
Yeah. So just so people know, to bring people along, so Johnny Watterson got your statements to the Gardaí and published them with a big picture.
With our permission, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. With a big picture of George Gibney on the cover of the Sunday Tribune.
After he'd been found.
Yes. Not guilty.
Nearly, well, as good as.
Well,
yeah.
He got off on a technicality. Sorry.
And then he just had a reaction from lots of members of the public who just refused to believe the survivors and believe what George Gibney was saying. And then, you know, also people within the Irish Amateur Swimming Association at the time, you know, refusing to accept any culpability or to acknowledge the fact that Gibney was an abuser. And then you had this sort of reaction when the podcast came out, and particularly reaction to the podcast episode with Burr and Trish, and people weren't afraid to embrace the podcast or weren't afraid to listen in and tackle it head on. They listened to it every Thursday morning when it came out, and they got in contact with the survivors, and they, you know, expressed really clearly this love and respect for all the survivors, like Chalky, Trish and Burr. So I think that's a really beautiful thing to kind of see how Irish society has changed over that period of time, and it's really important.
I don't know if you would have envisaged this when you set out to do it, but you've brought people together in a community of survivors, which is amazing, because out of the podcast, people have contacted you and contacted the Gardaí. Mm. These are people who've never told their stories before.
Yeah, and people who've also, I found out, Maeve Lewis of 1&4 has told me that many other people have come forward to speak to 1&4 since the podcast series has come out and sought help in that way, which is a really lovely thing to hear. And yes, you know, we had an email address for people to contact throughout the series, and we allowed the podcast series to develop on the basis of new information coming through from people who might have been affected by the story. So, you know, we got hundreds of emails, and, you know, by the end of the series, we had 18 people who had come forward to say that they had been sexually assaulted by George Gibney. And now it's amazing, because that email address, whereisgeorgegibney@bbc.co.uk, is still open, and there's still a trickle of emails, and people might listen to it, you know, a year after it came out first. And somebody only last week got in contact with me. It was a man to say that he's gone forward to the guards regarding another abuser. So it is really lovely to hear that, you know, people felt a lot of solidarity and felt that they weren't alone when they heard the voices of the other survivors. It's really special.
So where are things now? Where is he? Will he ever be brought back here? Is there still an open file, or what's going on?
Yeah, I suppose I can't answer that question really, Ray. I can only to say that there's still a Garda investigation that's open on George Gibney, and that he still lives in Altamont Springs in Florida. Whether will he be brought back to Ireland, I don't know. I wouldn't be too optimistic about it at this point, as annoying as that is. But I really, you know, I hope in some ways that we can see just real positives that come out of the podcast series that are beyond him, you know, being brought to justice in that way.
Yeah. And I think it's really, really important that, you know, people who haven't been abused are all about the let's get George Gibney.
Right.
But like what I would be saying here today is, if you're out there and you were abused, just tell somebody, tell anybody. You don't have to go to the guards. You don't have to, you know, just share your secret. If you're ready and you wish to, just share your secret and make it a bit better for yourself.
And if you don't want to say it to somebody in your immediate family or friends, there are helplines there, and you can go to rte.ie/helplines for those. And just text coming in here for the 2E. Fantastic podcast from Mark. As Trish mentioned, a dark subject and so unfair for Gibney's victims. Listening to Trish, she's definitely not let Gibney win. I commend her bravery. And I heard the entire series completely gripping and immersive, says John Ternure. And Trish Carney, you are extraordinary. Listen to you on the radio now. Your strength and eloquence is astounding and a comfort to so many people listening in. And that's from Kat. So you're fine. The book is brilliant. I'm going to point people towards it again,
because
I know you did the whole thing, the Late Late Show, and also before Christmas.
And can I just clarify, my mother ended up coming round and just being like a Rottweiler.
Yes. So because you fell out over it, didn't you? Well,
we fell out in an Irish way. I went to visit her all the time and we just didn't talk about it.
Aha, right.
So that was our falling out, really. Yeah.
Above Water is Trish's book, Stolen Childhood, An Enduring Scandal, A Survivor's Story. And you're fine, you're not getting the flashbacks or...
They'll be a part of my life forever. Right. Yeah. But I've...
You're so matter of fact about it, but that's the way you cope,
as
is
I
it?
Say, I have scars and lots of people have scars for different reasons. You know, I have a very close friend and she lost her beautiful boy, Daniel, and she carries her scars. And you know what? We share things together and she says that she's had to learn to accommodate such shocking grief in her life. And I think... It's very different, of course, losing your child to what I'm comparing to, but I do have to accommodate it in my life.
Okay. So it's this day fortnight, 20th of April, in the National Concert Hall. It's the making of Where is George Gibney? And all the proceeds, every penny goes to 1 in 4 who are doing brilliant work with victims, survivors of sexual abuse. You can go to nch.ie for tickets. Mark Horgan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray.
Well done again. And Trish Carney, thank you very much.
Thanks a million.
Well done again. Okay.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.